Hi, I'm Marvin Olney, host of To The Point in Which Way LA, and thanks so much for listening to our programs. If you're like me and you need help navigating the busy film awards season, I've got a podcast for you to check out. It's called The Treatment, hosted by Elvis Mitchell. He goes beyond the plot to understand what inspires the actors, the filmmakers, the producers, and others to do what they do. You can find The Treatment on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To The Point.
Will terrorism in France mean unity or division? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Massive turnouts in Paris and other cities yesterday were a demonstration of national outrage against terrorism and anti-Semitism. Already, many Jews have been leaving France, with almost 5,000 security forces now assigned to guard Jewish schools and synagogues. There's also concern about an anti-Muslim backlash based on fear that more young Muslims from impoverished suburbs will be radicalized. Will last week's violence fuel far-right political parties in France and the rest of Europe, or lead to cultural dialogue? Today's talking point, what's the reaction in Washington? First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Olney back with To The Point. Last week in Paris, 17 people were killed in terrorist attacks on a satirical magazine at a kosher grocery store. Yesterday, some 3 million angry people took to the streets all over the country. Despite that show of national unity, can France contain a backlash against Muslims or increased anti-Semitism? What's the potential impact on the rest of Europe? Today's talking point, the White House concedes it should have had higher profile representation in France yesterday. Will Republicans in Congress speed up funding for the Department of Homeland Security? First is news update. Secretary of State John Kerry arrived in Pakistan today for 2 days of security and economic talks with the nation's top civilian and military leaders. This comes only a month after a devastating attack that killed 140 people at a military school in Peshawar. Kerry is calling for Pakistan to crack down on militants targeting not only the Pakistani people, but U.S. interests as well. Michael Gordon is national security correspondent with the New York Times. He joins us from Islamabad. Michael, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
What U.S. interests specifically is Secretary of State Kerry worried about?
Well, Pakistan has really been a vexing problem for the United States for quite some time.
Okay, we're having a very difficult problem with the line to Michael Gordon, who is once again reporting to for us from Islamabad in Pakistan. Again, the Secretary of State is there now. He is trying to get the Pakistanis to respond to terrorists targeting U.S. Interests. The Haqqani Network, of course, well known, I think, to a lot of our listeners, is one of the major sources of concern. Michael Jordan, now we apparently have cleared up the line. Michael, go ahead. Tell us what interests of the U.S. are at stake here.
Really, counterterrorism and security issues are really paramount, and it's the John Kerry's here also with General Austin, the head of the Central Command, and a big thrust is the terrorist threat in Pakistan and terrorist threat emanating from Pakistan to its neighbors.
Now, to what extent are the civilians in charge in Pakistan? To what extent is the military now running the country again?
Well, the military is really playing the dominant role here, particularly since that attack in Peshawar against the army-run school that killed about more than 120 school children, and the counteroffensive the army is launching in North Waziristan. So there is a civilian government, and Kerry needs to meet with both the military and civilian heads. But I think it's clear to everybody that the military is calling the shots.
What specifically does Kerry want to see happen?
Well, the problem in Pakistan is this attack in Peshawar and other attacks have had a galvanizing effect in Pakistan as far as the terrorist threat presented by the Pakistan Taliban is concerned. The Pakistan Taliban represents a serious threat to the Pakistan government, and it's mounting a counteroffensive against them. But there are other terrorist groups in Pakistan. There's the Haqqani Network, American forces and Afghan troops. There's Laskar-e-Taiba, which has mounted terrorist attacks in India. There's the Taliban, which has taken refuge in Pakistan and carried out attacks in Afghanistan. And what the Americans want to see is the Pakistan government go after all of these groups, not just the Pakistan Taliban, which represents a threat to the government's control.
What about the concern that's been expressed so often in the past that the Pakistan military and intelligence services are, in fact, encouraging the Taliban to take actions in Afghanistan next door?
Well, I can only tell you what the Americans are telling me at these meetings. And what they're saying is that with a new government in Afghanistan, with Ashraf Ghani replacing Hamid Karzai, there's an opportunity, a better opportunity for improved Pakistan-Afghan relations, and that there's also a sense that the terrorist threat in Pakistan may be getting out of control unless it acts against a broader array of groups. So the way the Americans present this is that there's a window of opportunity to act more broadly against the terrorist threat. But, you know, as usual, the proof is in the pudding. And there is one new minor news development, which is that the United States is now proposing to give $250 million to help reconstruct and rebuild the services in North Waziristan in the wake of this Pakistan Army offensive against the Pakistan Taliban. So
okay.
That's new news wrinkle that just emerged a few minutes ago.
All right. Well, thank you for telling us about that. Michael Gordon, again, a national security reporter for the New York Times, reporting to us from Islamabad. It's good, as always, to have you with us. Sorry about the phone connection. In a moment, will Tamarism in France mean greater unity in that country or greater division on To the Point?
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, we're only back with To the Point. 3 million people took to the streets of French cities yesterday. In Paris, the leaders of 40 countries marched in solidarity against terrorism. Now, as the search continues for possible accomplices in last week's deadly attacks, some 10,000 new security forces are being deployed around the country. Vivian Wald is based in Paris for Time magazine. Always good to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
What is the atmosphere in Paris at this point? After that march, that huge march yesterday in Paris and the rest of the country, and now with the new security forces being deployed?
Well, I think in general, the atmosphere in Paris is one of unbelievable relief and kind of exhaustion. I think people are sort of emotionally wrung out from the past week. And there was a sense when these SWAT teams moved in and killed all three jihadists last Friday evening that this was finally over. There was this obviously gigantic march yesterday. It was a day that I think Parisians will never forget. And now it's sort of a sense that people are moving on. Sadly, I mean, this might not be the end. And if you talk to intelligence officials, for example, in France, they will tell you that that they are expecting this not to be the end, and that there could well be further attacks on the line or in the pipeline.
How are they doing, do you know, in terms of finding whether there were other accomplices and if they plan other attacks anytime soon?
Well, there's a lot we don't know about, obviously. And, you know, the other thing to bear in mind is you saw two attacks in Paris, and as shocking as they were, there were 17 people killed. I mean, that's 17 tragedies, obviously, but it is nothing like the kind of terror attacks we've seen. I mean, not to mention 9/11, but even, you know, the 2004 Madrid bombings, for example, and the Madrid train systems, which killed 191 people. And for weeks now, British officials and other intelligence officials around the continent have been warning that they sense that there's something big in the pipeline, and that the combination between the amount of Western Europeans who are now with various jihadist groups in Syria and Iraq, together with just a rising sort of militancy, has made the situation potentially quite hazardous.
Will there be a sense of Paris being under siege, or France being under siege, with all these security forces, particularly at Jewish schools and other Jewish institutions?
I think that, you know, the Jewish community leaders, who I spoke to a number of them yesterday, are hugely relieved when they had actually had calls yesterday from defense officials saying that they were thinking of posting the military around Jewish schools and synagogues. This is actually the first time this has ever happened. You do not see military personnel around civilian sites like that. I don't think that they'll feel under siege. I think it's a kind of the kind of security that they've been asking for. Whether, you know, this is a sort of 9/11 moment, whether the level of security just on people's ordinary everyday lives will really change, we haven't seen that yet.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but what about the concern that there will be further radicalization of young Muslim people, particularly in the suburbs where there's a lot of poverty?
You know, this is a very long-term, you know, maybe intractable situation. I did spend time in the suburbs this weekend on Saturday. And, you know, these are not necessarily poverty. I mean, one shouldn't think of this as being, you know, what you might find in northern Nigeria, for example, where Boko Haram is very active. This is more or less lower middle class families or low income families. Yes, there's very high unemployment, but there are social benefits and there is public schooling and public health. You know, France has fantastic public benefits. It's not like you have people starving. However, there is a general kind of alienation and just a distance that you feel, a psychological distance, which has been going on for a very long time. This is second, third generation immigrant kids who are now getting into their 20s and 30s and who simply don't feel that they have a real stake in mainstream white France that you find in the powerful neighborhoods of central Paris, the kind of Paris that tourists always see. And they just feel like they live a different reality altogether.
Well, Vivian Walt, thank you very much for being with us and giving us that start to our program. Correspondent for Time magazine in Paris, always good to talk with you.
You're welcome.
Simone Rodin-Benzikin, is a Paris director of the American Jewish Committee. That's a group that works with governments on issues facing Jewish communities, especially with regard to anti-Semitism in Europe. Simone Rodin-Benzikin, thank you very much for being on our program.
Thank you for having me on.
Is what we just heard correct, that Jewish leaders feel that they're finally getting the protection that they've been asking for?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with Vivian very much. It very much reflects what Jewish leaders and the Jewish community feel. It's something they have requested for a while, basically just to be safe, not to fear going into a synagogue, not to fear bringing your school children to a Jewish school, just being able to, you know, live freely. So, I mean, on the one hand, we are not happy about the idea of sort of living in a prison, but on the other hand, we want security. So, the community is rather thankful for just, you know, being able to not fear.
What do you mean by living in a prison?
I mean, you know, it is to some extent, it's the reality. If you step back from it, is quite worrying. I mean, the reality is that we need to be protected, and that, you know, tiny little things we do as Jews in France are somehow an act of courage. You go, you live, for example, in the suburb of Paris. You are in a difficult neighborhood, and you decide you want to go outside of your out on the streets, maybe with a yarmulke on your head. This is an act of courage. If you go and on a Friday night and you want to go to synagogue for a Shabbat service, you take a risk. It's an act of courage. The fact that you want to take your kids to Jewish school is an act of courage. You know, only 2.5 years ago, in 2012, we had the murders committed by a terrorist called Mohamed Merah in a school in the southern part of France, in Toulouse, where school children died because they were Jewish. So tiny little acts are acts of courage, but to some extent, the very idea that we need to have this kind of protection means that we are not free. It is in some sort of a prison.
People in France, Jews in France, have been leaving over the years in some numbers. Do you think that any number will take up the offer of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to emigrate to Israel?
The reality is that many Jews obviously ask themselves the question if they have a future here. The Jews of France are extremely attached to this country, extremely attached to the values it represented. Jews have lived in this country, despite very black spots in its history, for 2,000 years. Many of them would like to stay here, but they fear, and they ask themselves the question whether they are responsible parents to have their kids grow up in such a difficult environment. So I understand absolutely those Jews who decide to leave, be it to Israel or anywhere else in the world. My hope is that the country is waking up to this very, very difficult reality that has been going on for a very long time. Things are starting to change, and the necessary measures we, for example, at AJC have been asking for will now be done.
Simone Rodin Benzikin, once again, Paris director of the American Jewish Committee. Karim Amelal is co-founder of Media Startups in Paris. He's a political science lecturer. He's also an Algerian and a French dual citizen. Thank you very much for being on our program.
You're welcome.
You took part in the Solidarity March yesterday.
Yeah.
How is the Muslim community being treated by French people in general now since the attacks of last week?
First, I have to say that the Muslim community is very shocked, of course, very sad, and wanted to express sympathy and solidarity with the victims. It's awful, you know. It's awful for France. It's awful for all communities. It's awful also for the Muslim community, and it's a crime against Islam and against Muslims, because, of course, as you know, Islam has nothing to do with that, but we are shocked. We are shocked, and we took part largely in the march yesterday. It was great. It was a huge and great and fantastic moment of national unity, and we need that. I mean, French people needed that, and we still need that. I think also now we have to move forward, and to respond to your question, I think that Muslims now, I don't know if we can speak, if we can talk about one community, you know, because we don't have really representative, we don't have really leadership inside the Muslim community. We are more like, you know, individuals, and those individuals want to act and to react as citizens, and they don't want to be treated as Muslims, but as citizens, as French citizens. And this is the main point. And sorry, to respond to your question, we fare now, of course, like as it was after 9/11 or after other terrorist attack in Western countries. We fare a surge of Islamophobia, of course, which is already very strong, as you know, in France. And we suffer from that. We suffer from a double standard concerning this Islamophobia also, because we don't talk a lot about that. And for instance, these few days, a lot of attacks have been committed against mosques, against Muslim families. Of course, it has nothing to do with the terrorist attack, and we don't have to make equivalence. That's obvious. But we must talk about that. We must move forward. And I mean, the French authorities and also the media and the elite have to treat Muslims, French Muslims, as citizens. I think this is the main point, because we have to gather people. And that was the sense of this beautiful march of yesterday.
Let me go back to Simone Rodin-Benzikin with the American Jewish Committee. Karim Amelal is saying in some ways very similar things to what you said. We know that France has more Jews and more Muslims than any other European country. What do you see as the best way to resolve some of these concerns?
I think the best way to resolve some of these concerns is to look at reality. We have had a history of trying to avoid the very difficult subjects. We have a tendency to use nice words to describe things, I think we need to look at the situation very, very clearly. We need to be able to identify where the problems come from, look at the very sources, and then try and deal with them. It's not by saying we don't have any problems, as sometimes has been the case in the past.
Karim Amelal, yes, France doesn't officially recognize race or religion at all.
That's
should
right.
Should it do so? Should it recognize reality, as we've just heard suggested?
I completely agree with Man just said. We have to put words on reality, and we have to move forward and stop talking about taboos, you know, and the beautiful values of republic and that kind of things. I mean, it's we have to move forward and to identify the reality and to put words on that. And I don't know if we need to recognize officially and formally race, and because we know the problem or the issue that could be raised doing that. But anyway, we have to talk about suburbs. We have to talk about community. You know, you asked me 2 minutes ago how the Muslim community react now and behaves now, but I can't tell you that, because we don't know. We don't have a community. We don't have a Muslim association. And this is a problem for detecting young people, for instance, going to make jihad in Syria, which has become, you know, like a huge training field in the world for people wanting to be a rebel. This is a problem, because we can't identify inside the community and the Muslim community, but also other communities.
I'm going to have to interrupt you simply in the interest of time. We need to take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue this conversation with our current guests and with others as well. Later on our talking point, the White House concedes a diplomatic mistake. Will last week's deadly violence change Republican plans for national security? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Take KCRW with you on one of our mobile apps. Available for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry devices. Stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and our News 24 and Eclectic 24 streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. We've been talking about the extraordinary display of national unity yesterday in reaction to the terrorist attacks of last week. And we've also been talking about the divisions that are present in France, particularly with regard to anti-Semitism and anti-Muslimism as well, if that is in fact a term of use. Bruce Hoffman is director of the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University. He's been appointed by Congress as an independent commission reviewing the FBI's post-9/11 response to terrorism and radicalization. He's author of a new book, Anonymous Soldiers, The Struggle for Israel, 1917 to 1947, and previously he's author of The Evolution of the Global Terrorist Threat. Great authority on this issue. Bruce Hoffman, always good to have you on our program.
Well, I'm very happy to be here, although not because of the circumstances.
Of course. Of course. Are there ways the United States can be helpful and that you and others who have dealt with this can be helpful to what's going on in France?
Well, certainly on a national level, the exchange of intelligence in particular, I think, is often useful, at least when to track individuals once they've left their own country and gone to other potential states where there are terrorist training camps or where we know that there are known radicalization processes is, of course, you know, of immense help. And I think as many of your, you know, other guests have been discussing, it's really to understand how this particularly, you know, extremist ideology has taken root in society and how it can best be countered, not through, you know, anecdote or emotionally, but through empirical research, really, understanding what's worked in the past and what hasn't and what might prove useful.
The brothers who attacked the satirical magazine, the man who held hostages in the Jewish kosher grocery store are dead. They were people who had apparently left the country or were in other ways under surveillance. What do you think happened, and were they lost track of?
Well, the reality is indeed French officials have said, is that you can't assign one policeman or one intelligence agent to every suspect. I mean, on the one hand, this is becoming a much more pervasive problem than I think anything that we faced over the past decade and a half, largely as a result of specific strategies that groups like Al-Qaeda and like ISIS are pursuing, where they're attempting to radicalize people in place, as it were, and inspire, motivate, and ultimately animate them to carry out attacks. I think, too, that, you know, let's face it, for the past 2 years, the focus has really been on both sides of the Atlantic, on foreign fighters returning to their home countries from Syria or Iraq or from Yemen and other countries. And I think even though the authorities in France were certainly alive and aware of the threat from indigenous citizens or residents, again, you're at a point now where security services are just becoming overwhelmed with so much quote-unquote noise that they don't have the resources, nor do we want a police state of that magnitude.
Isn't there also radicalization in French prisons? Is there a way to deal with that?
Well, that, of course, is a key issue, and it's not just something specific to France, is that the prisons become terrorist universities, in effect. And I think, obviously, the experience of Sharif Kouachi in particular, who came out even more radicalized than before, will cause a very serious rethinking of this. I mean, the fact that Jamal Beghal, who was serving a very long prison sentence for a 2001 plot to bomb the U.S. Embassy in Paris, seems to have been instrumental while in prison and influencing him, is something, I mean, I wouldn't say this is a quick fix, but it's certainly an immediate and, I think, an issue that can be much more easily addressed than some of the societal challenges that your other guests have, that are quite profound, have spoken of.
Bruce Hoffman again at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University. Let me go back to Karim Al-Malal, co-founder of Media Startups, again a political science lecturer in France, also an Algerian and French dual citizen. The French government has said and used this phrase, it's at war with radical Islam. Is that the right tone?
Yes, I think so. I think we have to address this problem because it's a true issue, and we have to fight against that. But we have also to keep in mind that people going to make jihad or to do jihad in Syria with Daesh and things like that are not at 100% Muslims. You know, we have in France a lot of people who are living not in suburbs but in the countryside who have nothing to do with Islam, who don't have any Muslim or ethnic foreign identity or origins, you know, and they want to go there because they think it's the place to be to be a rebel, and this is something we have to address. I mean, of course, I completely agree with the other guest just said concerning the jails, for instance, and that the jails in France are like in other countries. I love the formula, like terrorism universities. It's exactly the case in France, and we have and we can in the short term address that issue. But we have also to keep in mind that we have to move forward and to tackle issues like communities and gathering communities and struggle against the anti-system feeling which pervades all strata of society in France, and this is a big problem. I think this is not particular to France. This is also the same thing in other countries like Spain or Italy or Germany.
We're going to talk a bit about that later on our program when we have the time to do so. In the meantime, let me go back to Simone Rodin-Benzikin, the Paris director of the American Jewish Committee. What do you say to this idea of war against Islam? Is that an appropriate term? Are there other ways of approaching this?
War against not against
radical Islam. I beg your pardon. Obviously, it's very important
to make
that distinction. Everybody has to make that distinction.
Absolutely. And the reality is, I think we have been at war with radical Islam without knowing it for a while already. It's probably a good thing to put the words on it, but it's a different kind of war. It's not the traditional war we used to know. But the reality is, we are at war with radical Islamism, an idea of basically people who attack themselves against, who are basically attacking our values, democracies, everything we stand for, everything we fought for, and how else can it be phrased than war? I mean, they are definitely at war with us, and we are in consequence at war with them. So yes, it is. It is. We are at war with radical Islam. No doubt about it.
Let me go to Jörg Forberg, who is an analyst at the German Marshall Fund in Berlin. He studies far-right political groups all over Europe. Jörg Forberg, thank you so much for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What about the extension of this conversation to Germany in particular, but other countries as well, just mentioned a moment ago?
Well, Germany is a particularly interesting case, especially today, because, as you know, there is a number of protests taking place as we speak. There's been the emergence of an anti-Islamic movement in the eastern German town of Dresden that has gathering momentum pretty rapidly over the last couple of weeks. It's now tried to spread to other parts of the country without much success, though, so far. And at the same time, there's an increasing counter-movement in this country. If you look at Berlin or other larger cities today, then there is very substantial demonstrations against this new movement, and it often outnumbers the participants of that anti-Islamic protest movement at a rate of 10 to 1, I would say. So we see on this very day a very sort of vivid example of the, of the exchange between the different sides here. Surely this is something that will take place, or that we also see in other countries. My personal interest in particular is obviously with those political parties that are trying to ride this, especially on the populist far right. We've seen an emergence of political parties across Europe that turn anti-immigration, Euroskeptical, and that will certainly see themselves reconfirmed by the attacks in Paris last week and try to exploit those horrendous attacks.
Do you think that those parties, because of what's happened in France, will have a greater support from voters? Do you think that yesterday's massive demonstration against what happened might in fact work the other way?
Well, I certainly hope that people in other countries will find exactly the same answer as we saw in France yesterday, that they do not easily succumb to the temptation to turn even more critical of the Muslim communities in our countries or even hostile, and that they will not succumb to the temptation of casting their vote for these parties. But at the same time, we already saw in some of the reactions from these populist far-right parties across Europe that they are trying to exploit this this development and basically argue in a told-you-so manner. See, what happened in Paris is exactly what we forecast, so we are the ones to basically pursue the right political position on this issue. And this obviously is a very dangerous political development.
Let me go back to Bruce Hoffman at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University. How concerned are you about politics, not just in France, but other countries as well?
Well, terrorism doesn't occur in a vacuum. Even incidents like this, where I think they probably have less to do with the ideology of Al-Qaeda or ISIS and probably more to do with almost the classic expression of catharsis that France Fanon wrote about some 50 or 60 years ago during the Algerian Civil War. So, as I said, terrorism doesn't occur in a vacuum. It responds to the pressures in society. And we've seen for months not just the flow of foreign fighters from many European countries, but also the United States, Canada, Australia, and elsewhere, and the Middle East, but also growing anti-immigrant sentiment, the rise of nationalist parties with extreme views on immigration that, of course, have contributed to the almost parlous or explosive atmosphere that unfortunately gives rise to terrorism. And I don't see that, unfortunately, I don't see that diminishing in the near future. We almost have, to use the famous cliche, a perfect storm of a virulent jihadi ideology that has received a lot of attention because of recent events in the Levant and also in Iraq. We have societies that are confronting very serious problems within themselves about immigrant communities and who is an actual citizen of a country or a true national. And then, unfortunately, we have sentiments that are intolerant and also political parties capitalizing on it. And it really is a very toxic combination that's, in my view at least, almost without precedent.
Jörg Forbrick with the German Marshall Fund in Berlin. When there were revelations by Edward Snowden and since then about National Security Agency surveillance in this country of people in Europe, there was a considerable amount of reaction, especially in Germany. Do you think that this will lead to more people being supportive of that kind of surveillance or not?
I'm not entirely sure whether there's a direct link between those, because I think the Snowden and surveillance affair was primarily also about the relationship between the United States and Germany. Germans have generally been more reluctant when it comes to any form of surveillance technology used against citizens. We see a renewed debate of this today, but certainly people will accept that some degree of surveillance is simply necessary in order to counter some of these threats. And it seems that according to surveys, there is a considerable awareness or expectation even of those of such threats. I mean, until now, Germany has been very fortunate. It's been spared similar attacks as the ones that we saw in Paris last week or the London bombings a couple of years ago. But I think generally we can expect that Germany is also being at the interest of terrorists. about half of the population do expect or do see Islamic terrorism as a direct threat also to Germany. And this will certainly also come with an acceptance of some form of reinforced security measures and surveillance technologies.
Bruce Hoffman, do you think there will be more rather than less, not just in Europe, but in this country?
Well, I mean, I think the bottom line is we see the pendulum swinging in an opposite direction than it's been in for at least the past 2 years, at a time when there's no terrorism tragedies unfolding, when the threat seems not quite as sharp as it appears today. Obviously, there was tremendous discussion about the surveillance state and whether governments, not just the United States, but others were exaggerating the threat and therefore overcompensating for it. We're now in a position where we want to ensure that those balances with civil liberties and civil rights and freedoms are preserved, but also that we give the authorities, the intelligence and security services and law enforcement, the tools that they need. I don't know what the answer will be, but I think it will be very interesting that there will be a much richer and I think a much more specific debate than we've seen in recent months, because the threat is now clear and in front of us, given how France has suffered in the past week.
So do you think then that there will be in this country more acceptance of what is seen before as invasions of privacy?
Well, I think the political cost of not doing everything in one's in a country's power, of not being fully prepared, of allowing a lapse, which even the French authorities talk about, is that led to last week's tragedies. I mean, that becomes politically unacceptable. This will certainly receive a greater discussion and debate than we've seen. But I don't know. Snowden has changed everything in some respects, but then so have the events of the past week.
Bruce Hoffman again, a director of the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University. Thanks so much for being with us. Thanks to Jörg Forbrig, analyst at the German Marshall Fund in Berlin. Good to have you as well. And thanks to our earlier guests, Karim Amelal, political science lecturer of Algerian descent in France, Simone Rodin-Benzikin, Paris director of the American Jewish Committee, and Vivian Walt with Time magazine. 40 nations sent heads of state or foreign ministers to Paris for yesterday's march against terrorism. The U.S. sent the ambassador to France. We'll hear what the White House says now and how Congress might respond in the aftermath of last week's terrorism. In a moment on To the Point.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
Warren Olney back with today's talking point. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, Palestinian leader Abbas, even the King of Jordan, said to be a descendant of the prophet, marched in Paris yesterday. Here's White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest at today's briefing.
Some have asked whether or not the United States should have sent someone with a higher profile than the ambassador to France. And I think it's fair to say that we should have sent someone with a higher profile.
Jane Hartley is the American ambassador to France. Zeke Miller is a political reporter at Time magazine. Hi, Zeke. It's good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
This is pretty strong repudiation of their own decision, pretty contrite on the part of the White House.
Yeah, this is certainly a stunning reversal from yesterday, where the White House was defending their decision not to send anybody because of security concerns, and now saying bowing to the public pressure, both from the media, from Republicans, from the implicit criticism from other foreign leaders, saying that they really should have sent somebody beyond the ambassador. Who exactly that is to be determined. They're not saying who they thought about sending instead, but certainly they would like to have sent somebody with some greater stature to represent the United States at the march.
Isn't it something often that vice presidents do?
Yeah, as this is essentially what you've created the office of the vice president for, to attend things that the president is too busy or aren't high profile enough for the president to attend, or where the president's entourage, the massive security bubble that moves with the president, would be proved to be too onerous. That's what the vice president is there for. But even the Attorney General, Eric Holder, was in Paris for meetings yesterday and potentially could have been there had there been an ask, had his schedule been a little bit more flexible. Secretary of State John Kerry will be going there later this week. He was in India for meetings with the Indian Prime Minister, so he couldn't have made it. But certainly somebody beyond the ambassador probably could have made it. That's what the White House was responding to today.
Eric Holder, the Attorney General, would be appropriate more rather than the ambassador to France?
Certainly somebody who's of a higher stature, whether or not he was at the level that should have been sent, you know, there certainly would have been a level of criticism regardless, you know, had anyone beyond, but the president gone. But certainly they would have been mitigating the criticism that they faced yesterday and today. Josh Earnest, the White House Press Secretary, did say that had circumstances allowed, the president surely would have liked to go. And yes, this march was put together in about 36 hours' notice. And typically, just about every presidential trip, certainly an international trip, involves weeks, if not months, of planning. So there's a certain element of truth to that. At the same time, if the president decided himself that he wanted to go, Secret Service and others in the U.S. government would have made it work somehow. But Josh Earnest said that this wasn't a presidential level decision.
In regard to the vice president or the attorney general or the secretary of state, is the security argument still relevant, particularly, however, when you have heads of state, Netanyahu and Abbas, if Abbas is not strictly a head of state, but certainly a potential target. Is the security argument really for the vice president or a lesser official really salient? Does it really have impact?
Well, certainly for the president of the United States, he's protected more so than any other foreign leader, just in terms of the number of personnel, the restrictions that Secret Service and the U.S. government imposes on other countries, both in terms of the requirement for there being motorcades and closing off and large sort of adjacent areas and positioning sort of metal detectors along the route to screen people who would be attending the march. So certainly that would change the flavor of what we saw yesterday. And with somebody like the vice president, you'd see a lot more flexibility, and certainly a cabinet-level official like the attorney general or the secretary of state, there'd be a lot more flexibility in terms of what that security situation would be. And I think there would have been a way to make that work. Maybe the president would have been a little too complex, but certainly the vice president was something that would be a way to do it that would not have impacted the nature of that event.
So we heard the White House press secretary make this very strong statement. Really, we should have sent somebody of a higher profile. Are they really kicking themselves inside the White House?
A good bit. I mean, I think they're looking at this as a missed opportunity. Certainly, they've been working to raise sort of the issue of the subject of Islamic extremism, but certainly the nature of sort of foreign fighters coming back from fighting alongside the Islamic State, coming back to their home countries and committing acts of terrorism, acts of extremism. They've been trying to make that point for months now and have been having trouble getting the rest of the international community on board to take this issue seriously. And here was a moment where they could have seized the moment portrayed themselves as leading on this issue. And in fact, they weren't there. So I think they're kicking themselves on that front. But they're pointing out that they're still leading on this issue in terms of convening a summit next month on countering extremism, as well as they've been in close contact in the investigation into the attacks last week in terms of tracking where those extremists came from, where they trained, where did they fight, and who were they in contact with.
Zeke Miller again, political reporter at Time Magazine. David Hawkins is with us, senior editor at Roll Call, who's covered Washington for more than 25 years. His blog is Hawkins Here. Always good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Warren.
What are you hearing in Congress? Are they being critical of the White House?
Certainly plenty of sort of rumbling, in the cloakrooms. The only member that I know who's actually gone on camera to slam the president was Marco Rubio, Republican from Florida, presidential wannabe, we think, went on CBS this morning and said this was a bad error in judgment. But I think that it is safe to say that even in the president's own party, there is sort of a little bit of head scratching that they've lost their whatever skill they might have had at sort of stage management and political messaging And it was a little, I think it was surprising to a few of the Democrats that I spoke to this morning.
What about policy planning on behalf of the new Republican majority in the Senate and, of course, joining the Republican majority in the House? There have been threats not to fund the Department of Homeland Security because of a president's executive action with regard to immigration. Is the Department of Homeland Security liable to sound a lot more important to them after all this?
I think that's true. I think we will see some of this starting to play out. We'll know how, if at all, the Republicans are going to change their tune starting tomorrow. The House will actually take up this legislation that would fund the Homeland Security Department for the rest of the year. People may have forgotten over the holidays that right before the holidays, the Congress and the President agreed on a budget for the entire rest of the government except DHS, because DHS includes the immigration bureaucracy, and the Republicans did not want to give them a full year's budget until they'd had this fight, but they were persuaded to put it off until this year. My own sense of it is that this, what has happened in Paris and the sort of heightened anxiety about terrorism, not only around the world, but if they're, you know, so-called sleeper cells, and we don't really, you know, more anxiety about domestic terrorism, that kind of works to the president's benefit in this fight. That he will be able to say what he said all along, which is that I'm not going to have allow the Homeland Security Department's budget to be held hostage over a fight that I shouldn't even be having to wage. I'm acting within my legal authority on immigration. The Republicans are wrong in saying I'm acting outside my authority. And I think that in this case, what's happened in Paris will kind of strengthen his argument in terms of public perception.
What about the idea of shutting down the government over this? Is that pretty unlikely now?
Well, it isn't the whole government. It would just be DHS.
Just DHS.
So it would, and I think that's, I think it's very unlikely because, as I say, I think the president would say, you know, to the Republicans, you know, how dare you even talk about shutting down the Department of Homeland Security at a time like this, in order to have this, you know, political business-as-usual fight.
David Hawkins at Roll Call. Quickly back to Zick Mueller, a political reporter at Time magazine. You mentioned a summit that the White House has called on terrorism. Tell us a bit more about that.
This is a summit that the president announced last year at the United Nations. So that was the summer, just, you know, as the U.S. was beginning the fight against the Islamic State of Iraq and Greater Syria, in Iraq and Syria, bombing forces there. Saying that this is to address fighters who are Western fighters, Western citizens who went there to fight alongside ISIS, who came back to the United States or came back to Western countries, and to convene and to study ways and to share information about how to both prevent people from going overseas to fight alongside ISIS and what to do about them when they get back. That summit has now been scheduled for February 18th.
Okay. Obviously, that will be a high-profile event. Zick Mueller with Time magazine, thanks so much for being with us. David Hawkins at Roll Call, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, sir.
I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast, is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.